Brilliant.
Such a beautiful day. We are up to chapter 23. Everybody has sheets? Anybody has sheets? Somebody has sheets. Okay, lovely pictures for us today. And in case you're wondering, that is David on the front, so we can still keep going. He's facing the wrong way, so you've no proof. But I'm telling you it's David. Bottom right-hand side. Yes. Do you know why you can't see him? Because he's in the valley of the shadow of death, which is why it's dark. But we will get to that. I think it's a star. But let's ignore that for the moment. Thank you for pointing that out. Okay. So, last week we did chapter 22, which was Ayelet HaShachar. It was about the rising dawn, the end of exile, the travails and challenges that come with being at the end of despair. And this week we have almost the opposite, a message of comfort, of confidence, of joy, where fear is cast aside. Now this chapter is very small. It's six verses, and I had some feedback that we may not be able to fit it in for 45 minutes, but we will do our best. And I think just culturally speaking, we have a question, yes.
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry. She's stretching. Excellent. No problem. This chapter in particular resonates with everybody. All you have to do is say the words, "The Lord is my shepherd," and everybody jumps in. It is a well-known song. If you look on Wikipedia, it lists every movie, every song, every play, every script that has ever used this psalm or a sentence from it. Just for a few, there's Titanic, Van Helsing, Terminator, the Book of Eli, Warhorse. I haven't seen all of those. I may not have seen any of those, but they all use that. And on a more somber note, this has been used in times of crisis for people, at times when you would think fear is what trumps all else. There was a famous recording of the last phone call made by somebody called Todd Beamer. I don't know if anybody's heard his name. He was on Flight 93 on September 11th, 2001. And in his final call, he called through the operator, who offered to put him through to his family, and he said, "I don't want to be put through, I don't want to stress out my wife, she's pregnant, etc." Presumably she got stressed later, but he didn't want to stress her out then, and just said, "Just repeat my words to her," and he said part of this psalm. George Bush repeated part of this psalm in his address to the nation the next week. This is captured, "I will fear no evil because you are with me." These words resonate and reverberate in our religious minds. So, that said, let's dive into the text. And I think a study of this text actually helps bring it to life a little bit, because although the poetry resonates, sometimes the structure, the patterns and meaning can inform that. So, there are two parts, as demonstrated by the split in the middle of the page. The first part is the first metaphor, because this is built of two metaphors. It begins with David seeing God as his shepherd and him as a sheep. That is the beginning. And then the end is a totally different metaphor, where David sees himself as a guest at the divine table. And those are very different metaphors, and in fact we'll see that there is a split even in the grammar. He begins talking about God in the third person. "The Lord, he is my shepherd, he, not he laughing, but he is. And then the second part, it becomes you. So while he is a sheep, he is cared for, looked after and supervised, but there is a distance, as there is between a shepherd and a sheep. You're not on the same plane. And then he enters the world of intimacy, being a guest at someone's home, where God is providing for him as a host. And then there is an intimacy built where he says, "You." And the key shift is at the end of verse 4, at the end of the first part. So let's dive in. Mizmor LeDavid, a psalm of David. Adonai ro'i lo echzar. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not fear or want. I shall not lack. Bina odesha yarbitseini, in his grass meadows he lays me down. Almein menuchot yinahaleini, by quiet waters he guides me. Nafshi yeshovev, he restores my soul. Yancheini b'maglek tzedek, he leads me on the path of justice. L'ma'an shemo, for his name's sake. Again, his name's sake. Gam ki elach begeitz amal, though I walk in the valley of the shadow of death, lo yirah ra, I will not fear evil. ki ata imadi, because you are with me. And that is the moment when ata, when you jumped in. And that's when the shift happened, right at the very pit of despair, the bottom of the ladder, when there is the shadow of death. That is when God becomes this intimate figure, you. I'm sure many of us have heard the parable of the footprints in the sand. Everybody heard this? Anybody heard this? That a person at the end of their life went up to heaven and has a bone to pick with God, because they're shown the history of their life through footprints in the sand. From when they were a child with a little footprint, and until they were older and the pace was smaller but bigger feet. And they were looking through, and as long as they were looking through the period of their life, they saw the moments of the biggest trauma and trials and challenges. The challenges with family, the challenges with friends, the challenges with religious doubts. That there was only one set of footprints. But in every other place, there were two. God and them, walking side by side. And in the moments of trauma, there was only one set of footprints. And they turned to God and they said, how could you abandon me at those moments when I needed you most? You're happy to stand at my side when all is swell, and you disappear off the scene at the moments of trial. And God turns and says, no, I was carrying you. And that's why there's only one footprint. And that's a wonderful tale, a nice parable. And that's precisely what is evoked in this sudden shift here. When David says, in the valley of the shadow of death, Ata Imadi, you are with me. There is an intimacy, it is no longer this abstract hymn, but a very meaningful point in this psalm. Shiftecha Mishantecha, your rod, a sheved is something which points the way, Mishantecha, and your cane, that which I can lean on. So you provide both the direction and the support. Hemaginachamuni, that is what consoles me. So that is the first part of the first metaphor. David sees himself as the sheep, and God as the shepherd.
Can I ask a question?
Please.
Is this the first one that we don't have business of you either use this instrument or whatever kind of direction to the conductor? And if so, why? There must be a reason.
Thank you. Excellent question. I was thinking of bringing it up, and I'd forgotten about whether I was thinking about it, so I appreciate that. We begin the introduction. It was Mizmor LeDavid, a psalm of David. We've had a couple of the LeDavid Mizmor and without an instrument explanation. So it's not the first time without an instrument, but Mizmor LeDavid is key. There is a huge difference between LeDavid Mizmor and Mizmor LeDavid. One appears when David finds himself in a terrible mood and he can't find his way out. So he starts to sing, and that brings him out. And then there are moments when David just is in a poetic mood and starts to write, and the psalm comes, and afterwards he has the divine inspiration. A Mizmor LeDavid, the psalm of David, is in a moment when he first writes, and he's not in a foul mood. So we begin here with David, with his poetic imagination, recasting out to religious sensibilities and painting it out in poetry. So there is that important beginning, Mizmor LeDavid, as opposed to LeDavid Mizmor. And you might have thought it would be the other way around. You might have thought, this is clearly a foul mood. He's down in the dumps. He's trying to lift his way out. But that's not how it's presented. It's presented in a moment of clarity, of the ability to see through the thickets, and to come up with this ingenious poem. So now we move on to the second part. In the middle there is a diagram, which is a painting or picture of this psalm, which appears in the Tehillim Museum in Israel, where, and my parents very kindly bought me the book, which has got all the different pictures in it. They heard I was doing this year, so they thought, oh, get a book, nice pictures, you like pictures, yeah. Got the words, you like words, it's a book, you like books. Well, your parents, you like us. So that was the general pattern. Now on to the second metaphor. Tarach lefanai shulchan. I'm no longer a sheep, or if I am, you're being rather friendly. I'm now sitting at your table, neged sorarai, as opposed to my foes. Dishamta v'shemen roshi, you moisten my head with oil, which was a practice. When they were hot, they would just spread oil on them, the ancient equivalent of air conditioning. Kosi Ravaya, my cup overflows. You have provided beyond my need. You have allowed me to sit as a comfortable guest. Ach, Tov v'chesed yirdefuni, let but goodness and kindness pursue me. Kol yimei chayai, for my entire life. V'shavti b'veit Adonai, I shall dwell in the house of God, l'orach yamim, for many days to come. So those are the two parts. The first, David is a sheep, God is his shepherd. And the second, David is a guest, and God as his host. Before we move on, when I was looking into this psalm, looking at some research, I leafed through a few different books. And one of them came up with a story based on this passage at the end. A story which, I don't want to be too harsh, but I would say repulsed me slightly. So I thought I would share it with you so I can rant about it. Because so far, only my wife heard my rant, and more people need to hear. Or I need to tell more people. It's unclear. You can tell me. Verse 6. Ach tova chesed yudafuni, goodness and kindness chased me kol yimei all the days of my life. And in this commentary it said, this can be illustrated with a parable. There was once a man, a family man, at home in eastern Poland. And he spent his days working and his nights running to do kindness and do charity and give shiurim, and he kept busy all the time. And every night he would get home at midnight, and his wife, already asleep, would wake up, slightly grumpy, a little tired, and say, why do you come home so late? We never see you at home. You give away our money in charity. You spend your time giving classes and caring for others, and you never spend time with your own children. So he was fazed by this question. He wasn't, apparently it hadn't come up to him that this was a problem. So he thought, oh, what should I do? So he travelled to Rodzin. Who was in Rodzin? The Chofetz Chaim was there. So he went and said, I've got to ask the Chofetz Chaim this question. Apparently she was an easygoing wife. If you want to ask the rabbi, fine, I won't demand anything. Went to ask the Chofetz Chaim, but there was such a huge crowd he couldn't get through to speak to the Chofetz Chaim, but he overheard the Chofetz Chaim give a Dvar Torah. And the Chofetz Chaim, he was standing at the back of the room straining to hear, and he heard the words of the Chofetz Chaim quoting this psalm. Ach tova chesed yirdefuni, goodness and charity should chase you. We shouldn't have to go out our way. They should be pursuing us. We should hope that these good deeds pursue us. And then the story finished, and without speaking to the Chofetz Chaim, the man's question was answered. I was no idea what to make of that answer, but what it sounded to me was like he was saying, it was excellent that we should be avoiding our family and running around doing things for other people. And I'm not sure that's the message to take away from this. I don't know if people disagree with that or find that a strange tale to have in a children's book, but either way, I think the power of this ending metaphor is goodness and charity should chase us, but goodness and charity doesn't have to be outside the home. They can be with our families, with our friends, with those closest to us. That said, we now move on from the psalm. I found it repulsive because it gave the impression a person shouldn't be at home and should be running around doing things for other people and ignoring their children.
No, that's not right.
He could be at home and people will come to him. Right. I heard it the other
way. Thank you for your charity. I will reread the story. I did go in prejudice, as we do to everything we read, but I will reread it. So I'm glad I shared it. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And he spoke about speaking about wearing a kippah at the Seder. He said one of the reasons is that Hashem gave Avraham a special reward of white clothing because he buried Sarah. So I forgot the Hashem quote. He said, well, what's the big deal that man buries his wife? Just good meetups. And he said that Avraham was a very public figure, and he was not a orphan, and he taught people in all kinds of public classes. But how he behaved at home when nobody was was the true measure of his character, and that's what Hashem rewarded him, because he learned from Hashem's lesson.
Excellent. And in fact, there is a Gemara in Bava Kama, I think, that says there was a man, Rav Bana, who used to go around marking the graves of ancient sages to make sure Kohanim wouldn't step in the wrong place. Right. And he came to a cave and he saw a man, an angelic figure, standing outside, who turned out to be Eliezer. Mm-hmm. And he goes to Eliezer and said, whose cave is this? He said, this is Avraham and Sarah. He said, oh, can I? He said, you can't go in. And he said, well, what are they doing? He said, Avraham is lying on Sarah's lap and she is gently stroking his hair. So clearly what the sages are trying to convey is a very close and tight relationship at home, which I think perfectly speaks to your point and to my bad reading of this story, what I think we should take away. But I will reread that story. Absolutely. Halachically, that is a concept. Absolutely. If you're giving charity, you shouldn't give to those living round the corner when you haven't given at home first. Excellent. Okay.
People do give a lot of public to doing things out of the home, not within the home.
I used to work, and after work, I would go take care of a grandchild.
Mm-hmm.
And people would say, Mrs. Topher, where are you going? I'd say, I help out a Caldwell family. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to say I go help my own family. No, because you go help a Caldwell family, I'm on the list.
Right.
Not in your own family.
Pretty low. So I think you're right. There is I don't know if it's a peer pressure or if it's a social construct. It's just the truth that that's the way that we operate. That dealing with family, well, obviously you're going to do that. Oh, you do more than that. And there's nothing against doing more than that. The question is not to neglect as close as
that. It's a balance. It's a happy medium.
Exactly. Like the golden mean we spoke about last week. Talking of golden mean, maybe I was mean on that story. Yes.
isn't it the position that the reason that most dad's children didn't turn out as well as we would have expected? Because it wasn't a very good thing.
That has been a critique leveled at Moshe for his treatment of his family, and I still haven't found a resolution. Someday, hopefully, I'll come back. But right at the beginning of Parashat Yitro, you've got the dramatic entry of Bnei Yisrael, or exit rather, the exodus from Egypt coming toward Midian, and you're beginning, and Yitro and Zipporah and the boys came before the people, and it says, and Moses ran and said hello to his father-in-law. And it's just, there's a huge gap there. Why? And I'm not yet willing to say that's a huge critique. I'm just waiting to find some resolution. But that critique has been offered by sages. It's not something new. That Moshe neglected to give Brit Milah to one of his children, and Zipporah had to. There's the Midrash that Moshe was almost eaten by a snake because he didn't concentrate on Brit Milah of his son. So, our leaders are not infallible. And I'm going to reread that story. So, thank you. So, we've now said that Psalm chapter 23, the Lord is my shepherd, which has captured the imagination. So, let's, before we move into the liturgy, when do we say Mizmor LeDavid, Roi Lo Achzar? Anybody know? Saturday afternoon, Sudha Shlishit. Excellent. Also at funerals. We say it at funerals, we say it at moments of departed, but we also say it every single week at Sudha Shlishit. In fact, some people
sing it
to some very bad tunes. And some people do it three different times. And we will get to that, trust me. By the end of this class, you will know exactly how many rooms there are in the Motel of Hell. Trust me, we'll get there. That sounds weird. It is. We'll get there. Yes. Excellent question. That's what we'll come to. And it relates slightly to how many rooms there are in hell. We will get there. Page 3 at the top. This is our question. Where does this song come from? We can talk about its power, but let's look at its beginnings. How did it start? Radav. Hamizmor hazeh am David al atmo. David said this about himself. As he was leaving crisis to relief. Okay, straightforward. Or it speaks to the transition of Israel when it leaves exile, which makes it actually link on to last week's psalm, which was right before the end of exile. This is that moment of transition. And when it's speaking about David, it says, this is speaking about David as he flees from King Saul. As he's running through the hills, hiding in the caves, fleeing all over the land, this is David saying, I won't fear. And if we look at the Tanakh in Shmuel, he does seem to have a rather calm composure throughout. He's willing to cut off the corner of his robe without him noticing and say, I could have killed you and I didn't. He doesn't seem to be wavering. He seems to be very confident, but also has the conviction not to kill Saul. So, that might fit. And now we have a wonderful picture of a sheep, but underneath that, we have a very long margin. And I wouldn't ordinarily put in something so long, but it really offers the panorama of David's life through the use of a parable, but also it stresses David's personality in a way we hadn't seen before. So if at some point you're like, you're reading too much Hebrew, tell me that. But we're going to go through, and I may skip at points. But Mizmor Hazeh, it is this psalm in particular, Charet et Korotav Meit Hayetor Roet Son B'Midbar Ad She'ala L'Melucha. It is this psalm in particular that traces David's life from when he's young as a shepherd until the point of kingship. So this is the psalm. If you want to know, if someone says to you, give me one psalm that gives me a key into David's psyche, according to the Malbim, it is Mizmor Chaf Gimel, 23. Techila Yashkif al Reshit Yimei Chayav. The beginning of the psalm looks at David's beginnings. Eight hitbodedim hatzon b'midbar, the moments when he's secluded, isolated, alone with sheep in the desert. V'hidme et atzmo katzon ro'er, and he sees himself, reflected in his profession, he sees himself, ro'er ha'nabdesha v'et adonai k'ro'er ha'mashkiach alav v'ein chemla. He sees himself as the sheep, fulfilling himself through his vocation. He is the shepherd and sees God as his shepherd. He sees pattern and symmetry in life. Hashanim ha'ele him hayu etzlo nivchar yemei chayav. These years of his life remain in David's psyche as the golden years, as the best years of his life. Ba'od hitboded im kono, when he secluded with his maker, contemplating the cosmos. Ba'od yizmer lefanav al higayon b'chinor ha'im zmirot Yisrael. And he is playing music like you've never heard. He is composing songs and psalms and tunes. Ba'od lo natal alav keta hamlucha lahafrida min hadveikut im Hashem. And these are the years before the crown on his head, the pressures of governance take him away from godly reflection. Sheken matzinu, because actually this proves the point we find, shegam achrei malacho, after he becomes king, kara et atzmo tamid b'shem ani vadav. He constantly refers to himself as poor and downtrodden because he suffers under the pressures of leadership. And we see this throughout his life. In fact, when we saw Psalm 2, Perek Bet, he spoke about, everybody is rebelling against me. I've got internal enemies. I've got countries coming on all sides. People want to throw me out. My own son rebelling. And he's like, I just want to be in the field shepherding. Who hasn't felt like that at some point in life? And you're just so busy. I've also thought, you know, I just want to deliver pizza. I just want to forget everything, have closed hours, clear instructions. Maybe that's laziness rather than wanting to reflect with God. But pizza can take you to God. These years, this time, this phase of his life was the most rich for him. But then God wanted to take him out of this life. He wanted to set him up as the shepherd of his people. He created pretexts. All that he would be taken to the house of Saul, to play the instrument. David somehow, fate or God, as the case may be, determined circumstances that David ended up in Saul's house playing for him. And then he put the idea in his heart, inception, to make him fight the giant Goliath. So here, although we're seeing David always wanting to pull towards isolation, hitbodedut, seclusion with God, God is doing the opposite of what he did to Pharaoh. He's implanting images of heroism in his heart. Go and fight Goliath. But he le shame and he build a reputation. And then he raised Shaul's anger against him and gave him his daughter, the Me'ar Elot Plishtim, fighting against 100 Plishtim. And then Saul chased him and pursued him to kill him. And if you're looking for a theological justification for David's tattered life, it is in order to ensure David's success until he gets to kingship. To train him through, this was boot camp for David to be king. But all of this, every moment, was a tense moment for David. He never really wanted to fight Goliath. He was not overbearing in confidence. He never really wanted to slaughter Philistines and marry the daughter of the king. He wanted to be in his field with God. He always wanted seclusion. And the images of memory in his mind always went back to those good days. Look back to those days as opposed to the days of kingship. And now he gives a story, a parable. And this captures David's life. Keben melech yoresh atzar. We're talking about the heir of the throne, a young prince, Asher ma'as b'shevet malchut, who rejects the scepter of leadership. This is the equivalent of Prince Charles, who's now controversial in the news because he compared Putin to Hitler. Whatever you think of that. That's the equivalent, if you can imagine this, of Queen Elizabeth retiring, or something else, and announcing himself I don't want this. I'm going to be a shepherd.
Never.
I said, if you can imagine it. Okay, so let's not talk about the child. Prince William, in 50 years' time, turns around and says, you know what? I've seen what that royal life can do to you people. It took away my mother. It's brought controversy on my family. I want to leave. And at that time, Charles is like, okay, we're not having this. Although in the model now, Charles is God, so we may now have to move past that. So, Ma'asbashevet Malchut, and this son rejects kingship. He says, I'm not doing this. I don't want to be king. I don't want any of these troubles. I'm going to go live in the woods. And he runs off and he builds a little hut in the forest. At this point, you might have him signed up for a home somewhere. But he's now living in the forest. The king said to one of his servants, you go and set that booth on fire. Presumably when the prince isn't in. And at the time when the prince went to escape the smoke him out, the king said. So he tried to run away from the smoke. He said, okay, I can't live there, I got smoked out. And he lives in a house that's slightly closer to the city. He was at the deepest part of the forest. And now he's moved into a little house down the road.
Where are we?
Yes, it was in the yard, but it's towards the city. In the forest. So the servant lit that house on fire too. And then each day, one moment at a time, the servant lights each house on fire. Keeps moving house closer and closer to the city, further and out the forest. And this kept happening. It keeps happening until he moves back into the palace. Presumably the king's dominion is a little cindered at this point if every other house has been burned down. I've said that. At that point the son realizes that all this misfortune had been the strategy of his father to get him to move back home. A simple note might have sufficed. But that was not his strategy. And this is the way he paints the whole episode of David's life that seems to, like pinball, go from one tragedy bumping to the next. And this is all to get David shaken out of his, what we're viewing here, as religious complacency. Saying, I want to live in seclusion, I want to look to God, I want to contemplate the cosmos and the universe, the meaning of life. And God says, that's all nice and well, but you've got to get out. You've got to do something, you've got to lead, you're an excellent shepherd. And you now need to use those skills and talents in shepherding of people. And this, for the Malbim, we'll stop there, is what sums up this psalm. When David, all the way through his life, looks back to the young years of being a shepherd. Hashem ro'i lo asar, when God was my shepherd, I lacked nothing. And then the acknowledgement of moving from that stage to being the guest at the king's table. And recharacterizing that as also good years, but always looking back fondly on the years before that. Okay. So now we've seen a couple of explanations. We've got a little bit of time left. We won't read all the boxes that remain. But we're going to turn to liturgy. We say that every week at Sudash Lishit. We sing it sometimes three times with three different tunes. That might be so not to bore people to death, but we will get to that. So, Sudash Lishit, or Shash Sudas, as some people call it. Do we have to do it on Shabbat? Is it an obligation? We have a nod? Yes. Where's the pasuk? That's the first question. If you say it's obligation, I'm going to have to ask you. Where's your source? Anyone? I'll give you a clue. It's on the sheet. We'll get there. Top box, page 4. This is the Talmud, Gemara in Shabbat. Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis taught. Kama se'udot chayev adam le'echol v'shabbat. How many meals does a person have to eat on the Sabbath? Shalosh, 3. There's another opinion that then says, actually 4, but we won't get to that. 3. Why 3? And now here's your source. The next time someone asks you, you can jump out. Vayomer Moshe, and Moses says to the people, Achaluhu Hayom, eat it today, speaking about the man, the manna. Ki Shabbat Hayom, la Hashem. Hayom lo timtzau basadeh. Eat it today, because today is a Shabbat for God, and today you won't find manna in the field. You have to collect more on Friday and use it on Shabbat. So it says Hayom three times, and that is the source. Most commentaries say that it's rabbinic, and this is what's called an asmachta. It doesn't actually say eat three meals today. It's the rabbi saying, look at this passage. It says, let's eat three times on Shabbat, and it doesn't make it less important, just makes it on a different gradation in legal terms. Okay, so you've got to eat three times. Let's look quickly at the Rambam. Next box. Chayav adam le'achol shalosh sudot b'Shabbat, achat aravit v'achat shacharit v'achat b'mincha. You have to eat three meals, evening, morning, afternoon. But certainly zaher v'shalosh sudot elu shalifchat menklal, and be exceptionally careful not to reduce the number. Eat three. Va'afilu ani hamit parnes min hatzdaka, even a poor person who gets his sustenance from charity. So is shalosh sudot, has to eat three meals. The same remark is made about the four cups on Pesach. So three meals, four cups, even if you're poor, you have to look out. But if it's a short winter Shabbatot in Chicago or London, and you have just eaten a massive lunch, or you always fast, you don't have to eat. You don't have to make yourself ill. And those are three controversial points. The Rambam says you have to make Kiddush, you have to have two pieces of bread, like a Mishnah, and also on Yom Tov. And all three of those points are debated and argued. We don't make Kiddush at Seder Shishit. Some people try and have Lecha Mishnah, but it's not really a requirement. And most people think you don't have to do Seder Shishit on Yom Tov. That to the side, we now look at the Shulchan Aruch, the next box. Yezarim ma'od l'kayem Seder Shishit. And this isn't just about eating the three meals in general, but Seder Shishit in particular. Think about those weeks when Shabbat is coming to an end. And you've eaten a big lunch, and you know you're going out later, and you're going to eat, and it's like, do I really have to shove some gefilte fish in my face? I mean, what is the point? You have to be exceptionally careful to fulfill Seder Shishit. And if you're really full, this doesn't have to be a lavish feast, just have a nibble, as much as a kebeza. And if it is impossible, like you really can't push yourself to eat, you don't have to pain yourself. You don't have to force feed the filter fish into your face. But let's be honest, you knew this was coming, and the wise person has eyes in their head. Don't overstuff yourself at lunch. You know it's coming. So that you can eat on Seder Shishit. Okay. So we've now seen three boxes: the Gemara, the source, the Rambam saying you've got to be careful, the Shulchan Aruch saying you've got to be careful and plan in advance because you've got to get it in. And in the last box, we'll talk about symbolism. We have a. Oh, you. That was a great stretch. I'm glad the question comes with it. Yes?
No, I've heard that this is actually really good because on Friday nights, we're hungry. And we eat for ourselves. And on Friday, usually, we're hungry. Even though it's difficult, but as we read over here, we know it's coming, so if you slow down in the middle of lunch, knowing it's a short day, that's really just a doubt for it, not for your own fulfillment.
Fascinating. So we've got one approach that the third meal is particularly to slow you down, to make you conscious of the fact you're doing it for God. Excellent. There's also the Abu Draham, who is, I think, 14th century Spain, who says, not entirely the opposite, but he says this is in order to create good habits. It's on Shabbat so that you don't overstuff yourself at lunch, to make you think about the meal coming, and so that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you don't start eating all over the place, you have habits set. Some people feel that makes it a little mundane, but it could be that Shabbat is the trend-setting time. It does sound like something the Rambam would say. Interesting.
How do you go from this beautiful psalm that's supposed to give you all this feeling of being with God to stuff that could be classified possibly as picayune?
As which?
This is what the Christians say, that the Jews are always... You're
pedantic,
you're
saying.
Lousy, no. little lousy rules that you're keeping, and what does that have to do with this great concept of love or whatever? You know, you're drowning in the rules, and this does. Usually I don't agree, but in this case it does seem
sounds
like
petty.
Going from the sublime to the ridiculous.
Excellent question, which is what we'll move to in the next books on the next page. But it's
you know, he always comes to it.
Yeah, we'll come there. We'll get there. Don't worry. I mean, it's a reasonable question. We have been accused of being blind to important values because of legal obsessionism. But I think, as people like to say, God is in the details. I think people like to say other things. But we're now going to look at the bottom box and find how essentially the architectural legal system we have is the springboard for all the values, because otherwise the values become amorphous and can be subjected to corruption. They're based in a legal system, which we'll get to. You have to have the rules. You're right. Often it's a little dismaying to sit and look at finicky battles about how much do I have to eat, a little bit of fish, a little bit of how much. But this is where it all comes from. Bottom box. Amar Rabbi Yossi. This is quoted in the Aruch HaShulchan, who was in the early 20th century and late 19th century at the same time as the Mishnah Berurah. And often these two are contrasted. The Mishnah Berurah is normally quite strict in his rulings, and the Aruch HaShulchan is normally quite lenient. So if you go to yeshiva, they'll say, oh, the Aruch HaShulchan, he's always very cool, he's makel on everything. But the reason is because, one of the reasons might be, is because the Mishnah Berurah was a Rosh Yeshiva, where you're in a yeshiva, you've got bachur and they're learning all day. So be machme. The Aruch HaShulchan was a shul rabbi, dealing with people who had jobs and families and work and had to cater for real life intrusions. It could also just be a personality thing. Their organization is completely different. Exactly. Both are ways to go. In fact, a rabbi once came to speak at Gush when I was in yeshiva, and he said, the Aruch HaShulchan, oh, he's always makel on everything. And the next 3 weeks, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who's the Rosh Yeshiva, found some way of weaving the Aruch HaShulchan into the shir and saying, he's not just makel, he's a very important figure. Need to pay attention. He won the Israel Prize last week, actually.
Yeah.
Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. Okay. So, bottom box, page 4. Arab Yossi, Yei Chelki im Mekayme Gimel Se'udot B'Shabbat. So important are the three meals on Shabbat, I wish my portion is with them. And the Levush says they are biblical. It's not an asmachta, they're not just a hint from a verse. It is min ha-Torah, biblically obligated to have three meals on Shabbat. And even if you're going to say, oh, come on, it's not really min ha-Torah, even if you say that, mikol makom vada mitkanat Moshe Rabbeinu hein sheken kibal mi-Sinai, even if it's not biblical, divine intention, it is at the very least a Mosaic decree made at the time of the giving of the Torah, with the most authority and the most history. Okay. Neged Gimel Avot. And these three meals are hinting or represent the three patriarchs. Neged Torah Nevim Ketuvim. And the Torah and the Nevim and the Ketuvim. That was an excellent translation. And when they were given, not Haman, but the man, Nitan Lahem Al Gimel Se'udot, they were given enough for three meals. And huge, awesome, great, vast things depend and hang on these three meals. And you can find that in Kabbalistic literature if you're interested. Which we will do on the next page. We're going to put on our mystical hats. Yes. Uh-huh. Not just making. That's true. In fact, there's a tradition not to study mysticism until you are 40. So I'm really sorry for all of those in here who can't do that.
And for yourself.
I'm nearly there, I'm growing a beard. Although I did ask also Rav Aaron Lichtenstein when I was in Gush, can I learn Kabbalah? I had a teacher in high school, long story short, who was somewhat of a mystic, who used to be able to see through doors or trick us into thinking he could see through doors, more likely. He used to shake our hands in the morning and say, oh, you didn't do Nagel Wasser this morning, which was quite a safe bet with eighth graders. But still, we believed him. And I got interested in Kabbalah. My friend once made a bet based on something he said, and he won a whole bunch of money. It was crazy. Either way, so I got to yeshiva, and Gush is not known for being mystical then. And I said, Rav Lichtenstein, can I study Kabbalah? And he said, well, you don't have to wait till you're 40, but, you know, wait till the You're a bit more the Talmud Chacham than you are now. Which was a nice way of saying, how about you start with the basics?
Yeah.
So I'll let you know when I'm finished. Which was sensible. So that said, these details, what seemed to be finicky, were beginning to build up a pattern. These three meals are not just random associations from a pasuk, hayom, 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 but actually beginning to fulfill a pattern of cohesion, whether that be in biological association with the patriarchs or textual and ideological association with the three books that bring together the law of God, the writings of the prophets, and the later books, which contain all the values above contained in those three meals. Okay. So now we take a slight diversion. Okay, time is running short. We're going to do the second box, because this box, when I first saw it, struck me. And I'm not sure how many have seen it before. It'll be interesting if you haven't. Top box says you've got to make Suda Shlishit with bread, and then they decide, well, some people say you don't have to do bread, you can just use meat or fish, and they say, oh, you don't have to do meat or fish, you could just do fruit. And then the conclusion is it's best to do Suda Shlishit with bread, unless you're really full, in which case you can have fruit, or on one occasion when you're not allowed to eat bread. What is the occasion you're not allowed to eat? Everybody knows, unbelievable. Erev Pesach, you can't eat matzah, you can't eat bread. What do? You have some fruit. Question addressed. Excellent. And now in the second box, something astounding. Yes, Omrim, there are those who say, Da asur lishtot mayim ben mincha lemarv b'shabbat. Oh, some people say it is forbidden to drink water between mincha and marv on Shabbat. So don't get thirsty. And this is now coming into halakhic work. Why? Because that is when souls return to Gehenna, which we'll call hell. This is a time where Kabbalah is seeping in to the halakhic work. There's a tradition in the Zohar that Shabbat, the fires of hell, are turned off. The gas is turned off, which is associated with why we're not allowed to do malacha, and because God says we can't use fire, he doesn't use fire either, so all the neshamas are, whew, day off for Shabbos. But at the time of Suda Shlishit, it's the time when they're starting to go back. So we're not allowed to drink water. I'd read to the end, but I'll just tell you. The significance of water is because on their day off, because they're in fire all week, they're pretty hot and they need to cool off. So on Shabbat, they're all drinking water and sitting in water. So if we're drinking water, there's a very old tradition, I don't have it here, from a midrash, that someone who drinks water, ben hashmashot, on Shabbat, is a thief. Because you're stealing water from these people who need it desperately. We may have parched throats, but they have cindered bodies and they need it. Which is strange. The conclusion is, don't worry too much about this. Some people are strict not to do it during the Yud Bet Chodesh, the 12 months when they're in mourning for their parents. Some people, really, it's only talking about water in the rivers. It's not talking about water in a cup or in a bottle. It's talking about drinking from a natural source. And then some people say, oh, it's talking about Friday afternoon anyway. But this is in a halakhic work. So next time we drink water, at the very least, give a thought to this law. Now, in the remaining 3 minutes, I can't read through the entire next box, but it struck me as being worth telling you. Based on a Kabbalistic source, how many rooms are there in Motel Hell? Take a wild guess. Close. 850, apparently. They've got quite an audience, quite a market. So apparently there are 850 rooms in hell, 580 of which have an oceanside view, so aren't so bad. 270 of which are bad. 270 is ra. And what are the others? 580 which are okay. That is the same gematria as, say, Gate Salmavet. So, as I walk through Gates Amavet, Lo Ira Ra, I will not fear the other 270 rooms. And as this happens, the righteous, as they sing Mizmor LeDavid, in their mind's eye, they lose the world, the corporeal, material world, and they go up to the other plane. And they go down to hell to try and bring out those who were taken down, to help other Shaim and bring them up. And they can't find their way around because the righteous aren't familiar with hell, so they have an escort. And this escort is an angel called Yehoshua. And he has engraved on his forehead the word Atah. Which is why we say, the gates are Mavet, Lo Ira Ra. As I walk through those rooms, I do not fear the other rooms, Ki Atah Imadi. Because Atah, you are with me. And as he walks along, he's carrying a candle of wax. And the word Shava has letters patterned out through Imadi. It's here. Imadi shiftecha umishandecha hema. That's Shava. And the next phrase makes the word Yahshua. And that's what this is all about. And in the last three lines of that box, Ubavadai hem mitpashtim ben hasadikim la'alotam min ha'gehenom. And all these souls that are stuck down in the thicket of hell turn, obviously, to the righteous for help. Alkein umrim zeham mizmor. And that is why we say this song. V'sudash lishit, shukarov lizman achazor v'shenim la'gehenom. At the moments when they have panic in their eyes, because these Rishayim know the break is over and they need help. And that's why we sing this, because this is the time when we have most compassion for those who are lost. And you can take this or leave it. So that's up to you.
Is this all taken from the Zohar?
This is from the Bnei Yitzhakar, who lived in the 18th century, who's basing it on a Kabbalistic work that's from the 14th century.
It's all Kabbalistic.
It's all Kabbalistic. But in the last box, I think we bridge a little bit of the fantastical world of Kabbalah to a world that can resonate with us. And this is the bottom box. B'Zohar HaKadosh, we're bridging, in the Kabbalistic work it says, Til to'inam di'istalku me'alme b'hazmana, at that time of Sudash Lishit, three people were lost from the world. And now Tzadok HaKohen jumps in with who they were. Moshe, Yosef, and David. Moshe died on Shabbat afternoon, which is why Mincha, this is traditional theory, in Mincha we say Sivkakha after Amidah, have justice, because that's when Moses died. Some people say that's why we have Shiorim on Shabbat afternoon in Moses' memory. Yosef, I have no idea for the source of that, Yosef died. David, there is a Gemara that said David died on Shabbat afternoon. That God promised him he would only die on a Shabbat, which is why we have Malava Malka, because David celebrates, got another week to live. That's the Gemara. So these three figures, the Shloshta Nikra Uroa Yisrael, and these three were the shepherds of Israel. Yosef provided for the people when they were in Egypt. Moshe provided the man all the way through the desert, and David, we know, is called Roa Yisrael, the last line and a half. V'sudash l'shit z'man sh'mistalku shlosha Roa Yisrael. And the time of Sudash l'shit is the time when these three shepherds left. Their souls were taken. Me'olam, and that's why we say Omrim Hashem ro'i lo echzor, we say, my shepherd, and I will not lack, shezel o yechzer lanu le'olam, because this will never be taken from our worlds. Despite their souls having gone, their values live on, their impact lives in our life. So to finish, a legend about Mizmor Chaf Gimel. We have minus 1 minute, so I will tell a brief version. In England, the British Empire, there was a competition. Where else would you have a poetry reading competition? They had one in London. And all the great minds, all the great speakers, all the great orators assembled to judge the best poetry. And as it went through the night, different figures gave different poems. Someone gave a poem from Wordsworth. Then someone gave a poem from Samuel Taylor Coleridge. And then a figure stood up whose cadence and pace was perfect, whose oratory was clear and captivating. And he said, Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd and I shall not lack. I lay down in the field and he restores my soul. And at that moment the audience knew who the winner was. He by far outperformed the rest. And then as the judge was about to lower the gavotte and give out the prize, a small Yiddish man at the back in his beard said, can I have a go? I don't know why he said it in a strange accent, but he did. And they said they were debating. This might debase the competition. His accent is clearly all over the place. He doesn't have the Queen's English. This, oh, maybe it'll add an air of comedy. Nice finish. So they said, okay, up you go. So he gets up and he says, in his strong Yiddish accent, which I will not try to copy, he said, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not lack. And at that time, people are smirking, laughing. And then as he goes on, he gets more ingrained in this song. He begins to shed tears, begins to wipe him with sorrow and grief and joy and compassion, and the audience is struck silent, tears falling on the cheeks of everyone in the room, and he wins the prize. And the person who performed before him thought, I don't understand what happened. He went up to him and he said, how did you do that? What's your secret? And he said, my friend, you're a great orator and you clearly know the poem, but I know the shepherd. And that, I think, is something we should take away, is that despite having seen the structure, we should know the shepherd.